The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, as far back as the early 1930s, Herbert W. Armstrong was prophesying of a coming unity between Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox. A few examples that I have here, you can find these also in our wonderful booklet, He Was Right. But this from the 1961 Plain Truth, October of that year. Mr. Armstrong said, the Pope will step in as the supreme unifying authority, the only one that can finally unite the differing nations of Europe. The iron jurisdiction over both schools and religion will be turned over to the Roman Catholic Church. Europe will go Roman Catholic. Protestantism will be absorbed into the Mother Church. It's going to be absorbed into that Mother Church. That's what the Plain Truth wrote more than 50 years ago. That's 1961. Another example here, this is from November 1963. And this too, the Plain Truth, it says, the final, albeit short-lived, triumph of Catholicism is recorded in literally dozens of Bible prophecies. Right now, whether we want to believe it or not, the stage is being set for the greatest revolution in religion the world has witnessed. The mighty problem of achieving unity is twofold. First, it involves reconciliation of the Orthodox schism that officially commenced in 1054 and divided the churches in the East. And then second, it involves the restoration to the Roman communion of all Protestantism, which developed from 1517 onward. And so there is this great reconciliation prophesied to happen. Mr. Armstrong made those prophecies, those predictions, 50, 60 years ago, as far back as the 1930s. And of course, in the 1930s and the 1940s and 50s, when he was proclaiming that church unity was coming, that it was prophesied, well, there were quite a few people in those days that scoffed at the thought of any kind of union between Catholicism and Protestantism. Well, that started to change slowly but surely, starting in the 1960s, as our booklet brings out. And then today, this week, you have the Archbishop of Canterbury meeting together with Pope Francis in Rome to celebrate the unity within Christianity. And these two are going to be saying prayers together. This is something that's a first since England's break with Rome 500 years ago. That's the way one headline put it. Prayers together, the Archbishop of Canterbury and Pope Francis in Rome. The South China Morning Post had this to say. The Archbishop, Justin Welby, will be granted a private audience by Pope Francis at the Vatican on Thursday morning. The two clerics have met four times before, most recently at last month's interfaith seminar in central Italy. It says closer ties with other faiths and branches of Christianity have been a priority for Francis since he became Pope in 2013. Our booklet just goes through all of the history, or the recent history, going back through the leadership of Pope John Paul II, and then more recently with Benedict, and now in these past 3 years, Pope Francis. It says here, this article does, about Pope Francis, he met top Orthodox cleric Patriarch Kirill in Moscow, of Moscow in Cuba in February, it says, and he's due in Sweden in October to as a guest of the Lutheran Church for events marking 500 years since the start of the Protestant Reformation. So this is moving fast. Francis has only been in there for 3 years now, 3.5 years. And right now, I mean, the prophesied push to bring unity, it's going to be brought on with more force in the end. But right now, the push is coming from both sides, from the Vatican and also from the Eastern Orthodox Church. And also, as we see from the headlines this week with respect to the Archbishop of Canterbury, it's coming from the Protestants. They're doing their part to push for unity as well. Another headline here, the 50th anniversary of the Anglican Center in Rome, getting closer all the time. That's what the celebrations this week center around. The 50th anniversary of this Anglican Center in Rome, sort of a Protestant or Anglican embassy. 50 years, established back in 1966. This article says the Anglican Center celebrates its 50th anniversary next week with a visit by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, to the city and to Pope Francis. It says the center's work, says its director, is driven by the impulse to unity implored by Christ. There's references in some of these articles to John 17, what it says about the church being one. And so there's a big push to follow after this teaching, this instruction of Christ, so they think, of oneness, of unity. Another headline here says, the unmistakable spark of Christian fellowship between the Pope and the Archbishop. The spark of Christian fellowship. These two really hit it off from the start, going back to 2003. This article talks about how that when the Anglican provinces worldwide started ordaining women as priests and bishops, that the relationship with the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church, they hit their lowest point in modern times, but that's all beginning to change, and dramatically. It says here, but now even Anglican women bishops sit around the table with Catholic bishops at high levels. High-level talks between the churches. It says the climate is now being described as an ecumenical spring as opposed to an ecumenical winter. It's springtime with even signs of summer in the air. Let me just play for you this clip from Vatican Radio. It's got, the host of the program, and she sets up the story with just some of the basic facts that have been covered in some of these news reports, and then she has an exchange in this clip with the New Zealand Archbishop David Moxon. He's the one, I think, that heads up this Anglican Center in Rome. This is from Vatican Radio earlier today.
Closer practical cooperation between Anglicans and Catholics in countries across the globe. That's a primary goal of a two-day visit of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, to Rome this week. The Anglican leader arrives on Wednesday and is scheduled to join Pope Francis for an ecumenical liturgy at the Church of San Gregorio al Celio in the afternoon. Also present will be pairs of Anglican and Catholic bishops from around the world who'll be symbolically sent out on mission together. On Thursday morning, the leader of the Anglican Communion will have an audience with the Pope in the Vatican, together with the heads of about half of the world's 38 Anglican provinces. The two-day programme of events, which also includes a colloquium on Anglican-Catholic dialogue at the Pontifical Gregorian University, is marking the 50th anniversary of the first official contacts between Pope Paul VI and Archbishop Michael Ramsay, followed by the setting up of Rome's Anglican Centre. New Zealand Archbishop David Moxon is the current director of that centre. He sat down with me to talk about these celebrations and about the most significant progress of the past half century.
There are three important elements. First of all, there's the agreement over doctrine, we have, I think, about 85% agreement over basic core doctrine, including baptism and Eucharist. We're working on other doctrinal matters. We've got agreement on marriage. We've got agreement on the way we use the scriptures, how we discern moral issues from the Bible. We've got agreement on kingdom of God, missiology. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we now enjoy a practical relationship, a partnership in mission between Catholic and Anglican bishops around the world, where the IARCUM, the International Anglican Roman Catholic Commission on Unity and Mission, is encouraging local people, including bishops, to lead together on justice and peace, on the kingdom of God. And then thirdly, we have the Anglican Centre in Rome, which is an embassy to the Pope. It's a presence of the Archbishop of Canterbury in Rome. It's a way of being local, friendly and collaborative with the Vatican.
Now, to mark this important anniversary, you've got the meeting not just with Pope Francis and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, but you've also got Anglican leaders coming from all over the world, haven't you, to, if you like, show in a very practical sense this partnership for mission.
Yes, there are two aspects to that. There's Anglican primates, about 17 of them from the 38 Anglican provinces of the world coming together, and they'll be with Archbishop Justin and in an audience with the Pope. Delighted about that. The second aspect is pairs, literally pairs, of Catholic and Anglican bishops from their own locale, the place where they work together, coming to Rome from all over the world, to be mandated to go out and intensify and to put on the balcony, if you will, their partnership hopes and dreams.
That's a little bit of an excerpt, I guess you could say, from the Vatican Radio. The host there interviewing the New Zealand Archbishop, David Moxon, who's the director of that center, the embassy. And he, as you heard, he's delighted about these two coming together, the Anglican Church and the Vatican, Roman Catholicism. And they're about 85% there as far as the basic core doctrine. And they're entering into this partnership in mission. And then you've got the embassy there. And then, of course, the leaders, these two, as I say, that hit it off from the beginning back in early 2013, the Archbishop of Canterbury and Pope Francis, seen laughing together soon after they first met. According to this piece from Christian Today, it says that the Archbishop saw the ministry of Pope Francis as prophetic and apostolic. This Archbishop of Canterbury is, in my view, the perfect partner for that kind of mission. That's quoting again from Moxon, the New Zealand Archbishop. Very excited, delighted about this partnership. Another one here, another headline from Christian Today. Archbishop Justin Welby and Pope Francis want Christian unity. It says here, when Pope Francis and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, join in prayer tomorrow morning, it says here, this will mark another step towards unity between Anglicans and Catholics. They will literally be singing from the same hymn sheet with the Sistine Chapel Choir, joined by the choir of Canterbury Cathedral. Events in Rome this week appear to show Catholics and Anglicans under these two remarkably similar prelates, Pope Francis and Archbishop Welby, could be inching closer together. This final piece that I have here just goes through and describes some of the tangible acts that can come out from these meetings, from these discussions this week. This is from AnglicanNews.org. It says pulpit swaps, shared retreats, joint action on social issues, and regular meetings between clergy are just some of the ideas for local expressions of unity between Anglicans and Roman Catholics taking shape during an ecumenical summit in Canterbury in Rome. This afternoon, during a service in the monastery church where they're meeting to pray, it says Pope Francis and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, will commission 19 pairs. Some of this was described by Mr. Moxon there in that interview. But 19 pairs of Anglican and Roman Catholic bishops to implement local expressions of unity in their diocese around the world. It says the commissioning of the 19 pairs of bishops has been organized by the International Anglican Roman Catholic Commission for Unity and Mission as part of a week-long ecumenical summit marking the 50th anniversary of the first public meeting between a pope and an Archbishop of Canterbury since the Reformation. The summit, which began at the weekend in Canterbury Cathedral and is continuing now in the Vatican, will also mark the 50th anniversary of the Anglican Center. As we mentioned a moment ago, it says, I've been deeply moved, this is quoting an Anglican bishop, I've been deeply moved by what has been happening. That's coming from a bishop in Pakistan. To see Roman Catholics celebrating the Eucharist in Canterbury Cathedral was a miracle. It's an answer to Jesus' prayer that we may be one. And it says here, his Roman Catholic counterpart, another archbishop, said that the two had agreed that their clergy would meet twice a year to agree methodology and to learn from one another so that our evangelism becomes more effective and powerful. So you see these steps being taken, and as I say, it's not just coming from the Vatican. The Protestants are reaching out as well. The Eastern Orthodox. Let me just take you through some of the scriptures. I gave you a couple of quotes from those old plain truth issues from back in 1961 and then in 1963. And so many of those old articles that talked about this coming unity, well, they went through scriptures like what we'll read here in Isaiah 47. Keep in mind, Mr. Armstrong, he wrote that Protestant churches everywhere are gravitating toward union with the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, that was in 1963. He said these religious movements are speeding the fulfillment of the prophecies of the resurrected Roman Empire. See, that's the real significance of this movement. Like so many other of these crises that we've discussed going on in Europe, it's speeding the fulfillment of the prophecies about the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Again, from that plain truth issue, as I read at the top, Protestantism will be absorbed into the Mother Church. Today, of course, we see that happening. Now, how could he know? How could he know this back in 1961 or 1963 or 1934? Well, look here at Isaiah 47. Verse 1 says, "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate." Here God identifies a daughter of Babylon. Not the Babylon of old or the original Babylon, but a daughter that emerges out of that old pagan system. And it exists even during the last days of man's civilization. Now, in so many ways, it's the same old Babylonian mystery religion of old. But in this end time, it grows so large that it encompasses the earth, ruling over many peoples from many nations, speaking many different languages. You can see all of that in Revelation 17. We'll go there in just a second. But here in Isaiah 47, well, verse 5, it refers to her as the Lady of Kingdoms. Revelation 17, of course, this woman is straddling the beast. Here in verse 8, Isaiah 47 and verse 8, it says, "Therefore hear now this, you that are given to pleasures, that dwell carelessly, that say in your heart, I am and none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children." This mother church, of course, lost all these protesting daughters centuries ago. But it has a master plan in place to ultimately bring those daughters back into the fold. Toward the end, as I say, it's going to be done as it's been done historically, by force. But right now, you see it being done through these efforts from the Anglicans, from the Eastern Orthodox, from the Vatican, from Pope Francis. But here, this prophecy in Isaiah 47, it's speaking of a time when the Catholic Church would wield supreme power, boasting that that she'll not know the loss of children or daughter churches. So this is prophesying of a time when that Catholic Church, that universal church, would attain a state of unity, quote-unquote, with its Protestant daughter churches. Let's look at Revelation 17. I mentioned it just a minute ago. A lot is said here, of course, about this woman straddling the beast power. And we've talked a lot in recent programs about the Ten Kings and about the Daniel 8 man to emerge out of the heart of Europe, out of Germany. But as you read through this prophecy in Revelation 17, I mean, you see how prominently placed this woman is. She's riding the beast, after all. And so we can't overlook her, for sure. Verse 5, it says, "And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth." And so this daughter of Babylon, as she's called in Isaiah 47, here she's represented as a mother of harlot daughters or protesting daughters. She came out of that ancient Babylonian system and then produced offspring. And God really sees them all as the same. They come from the same family. And really, even before these more recent efforts, there hasn't been that big of a difference in the doctrinal teachings of these two, whether it's the mother or the daughters, in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, this was brought out in some of those old Plain Truth articles as well, the fact that the Reformation or the rebellion back in the 1500s was largely against the authority of the Pope. This from the Encyclopedia Britannica. The medieval church was essentially an international state, and the character of the Protestant secession from it was largely determined by this fact. According to Britannica, it says here, the religious elements in the Reformation have been greatly overestimated. It was more or less a rebellion against the authority of the Catholic Church. They rebelled first and foremost against the papal authority. This is how Mr. Armstrong explained the history. This is, I think, from the 1960s as well. This is 1957. He says here, the Roman Church continued many centuries undivided, but the system of applying the principle of church government was all wrong. It ruled by the will of man, Satan inspired. It preserved unity by physical force. It was the instrument of Satan, therefore its fruits were evil. The Protestant movement failed to correct what was wrong. Because the Catholic government was a counterfeit misrule, they abolished the rule, speaking of the Protestants. They abolished the rule instead of yielding themselves to the divine government of God. They reasoned that every man ought to do what was right in his own eyes. Some wanted democracy, government by the whole congregation. They went the way that seemed right in their own eyes. Speaking of those Protestant daughters, I mean, that's why there's so many of them, so many denominations. But devout though they were, he writes, they had no firm basis for unity. They split and resplit. And today we have hundreds of Protestant denominations. That's what happened historically. And yet today we see this big push, this movement toward reunification and unity. Why? What's behind this? Well, the significance, as we already pointed out, is that it's going to have a dramatic impact on Europe, on the Ten Kings coming together. And then if you add to that another prophecy, Daniel 11 and verse 40, about the clash, the king of the north coming against the king of the south, that old crusade-style clash. Well, that factors into this as well. According to the World Christian Encyclopedia, in 1970, Catholics outnumbered Muslims by about 20%. And in the course of one generation, from 1970 to 2000, I mean, that figure practically reversed. In 2000, there were 12% more Muslims than Catholics in the world. But when you think about one way to expand your numbers and to do it quickly, you unify. You bring back the protesting daughters. It's all building to this major clash, this prophesied clash, this religious clash. The Vatican can reverse this demographic trend in a hurry by bringing back in the daughters, bringing them back into the fold. Now again, they're only going to go so far with this peaceful negotiation, and it's only going to bring those protesting daughters in so far. Total unity between the Roman Church and those protesting daughters won't actually occur until immediately after that clash between the kings of the North and South. That's the event, as you know, that triggers the beginning of the Great Tribulation. And then at that point, like my father says in the He Was Right booklet, it quotes him toward the end of that Returning to the Fold chapter, then the Mother Church is going to abandon its efforts to woo the daughters back by flatteries and instead revert to the age-old method of preserving Christian unity by exerting physical force. This has been the track record. This is history. Inquisition style. And the daughters are going to be forced back in. Revelation 17, just speaking of this seventh and final resurrection, verse 13 says, "These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast." They have one mind, and so there's going to be some strong unity and a spirit behind it, oneness of mind, giving power and strength to the beast. And notice what it results in. Verse 14, it says, "These shall make war with the Lamb." That's really where this ecumenical movement is ultimately leading. It's leading into a head-on collision with Jesus Christ. That's what's motivating it. The spirit behind it, coming from the devil, I mean, he's amassing his forces to fight against Jesus Christ. He's working overtime, even now, behind the scenes, to unite all of the world's religious denominations and sects so that they can jointly oppose and fight against the coming rule of Christ on earth. Satan hates God's government. He knows his time is short. He knows that Jesus Christ is about to return. It may seem contradictory in one sense, given that he's the author of confusion. He loves division. But he is bringing those divided churches together because of how much he hates Jesus Christ. He's gathering the forces of this world together to make one last unified stand against Christ. That's what your Bible reveals. When Jesus returns, when he comes back to set up God's perfect government, he's not going to be welcomed. The religions of this world are not going to welcome him with open arms. The nations of this world are going to fight against him. "These shall make war with the Lamb." That's what your Bible says, verse 14. "And the Lamb shall overcome them." I don't want to leave that part of the verse out. Why? Well, he's the Lord of Lords. He's the King of Kings. Back up to Revelation 11. Again, just to reinforce this point, that Christ is not going to be welcome when he returns to this earth. It says in Revelation 11 and verse 15, "And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven, saying, The kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." This is talking about God's literal world-ruling government, God's kingdom. It says the nations of this world are given over to Christ. But this doesn't happen, of course, until Jesus himself overcomes them, as it says in Revelation 17:14. Notice further, it says here, this is Revelation 11, verse 16, and the 24 elders which sat before God on their seats fell upon their faces and worshiped God, saying, We give you thanks, O Lord God Almighty, which are and was and are to come, because you have taken to you your great power and have reigned. Here's the tremendous excitement. You see, from the angelic realm, they're excited to see the reins of government finally given over to Jesus Christ and the bride, the true church. Verse 18 says, and the nations were angry, and your wrath is come. See, the nations are upset about this. They're angry at the return of Christ. And your wrath is come in the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that you should give reward unto your servants the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear your name, small and great, and should destroy them which destroy the earth. That's what mankind has been doing. That's what the nations of this earth have been doing. They've been destroying this earth. We've been destroying each other, and the nations together and the religions together will be angry when Jesus Christ returns. And they'll join together in unity to fight against him. But the Lamb shall overcome them. The Lamb shall overcome them. And then finally establish peace on this earth. Isaiah 47, just going back to, well, we don't need to go back there, but that prophecy also speaks of this stunning demise of this powerful, universal church. Once she gains back those daughter churches, the ones she believes are rightfully hers, and then wreaks this destruction upon the earth during the prophesied Great Tribulation, well, it just brings us up to this clash. The forces of this world uniting together to fight against Jesus Christ. That's the significance of all of these developments we keep bringing out on this program. We're just moving one step closer. One step closer. This unity, this push for unity between the Catholics and the Anglicans and the Orthodox, it's bringing us one step closer to when there will finally be true Christian unity under the Christ-led government of the Kingdom of God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. World War III is closer than you think. Terrorism and economic crisis is tearing Europe apart. The only nation that can lead Europe out of the mess is Germany. But Germany can't do it without a strong leader. Bible prophecy says they will get one. He will unite Europe in a new Holy Roman Empire. But it won't stop there. Every time Europe unites, war breaks out. Find out how it will happen again, one last time. Request a free copy of The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. What will the Holy Roman Empire do after it has stopped terrorism and saved Europe's economy? This book will tell you. You'll be shocked at how much it will affect your future. Act today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
On yesterday's program, I didn't have time to get through some of these other clips from Herbert Armstrong about, in particular, about the rules of success or the laws of success that he was beginning to learn even as a young man, going back to his late teen years, those first couple chapters of his autobiography. It's packed in there with quite a lot of instruction, particularly for young people. Mr. Armstrong had that spark of ambition when he was 16 years of age and really wanted to do something with his life. And then a couple years later, he came upon that book, Choosing a Vocation, and he went through an exhaustive study that resulted in him finally deciding to pursue advertising. And as it happens, his Uncle Frank there in Iowa also was in the advertising field, a very successful one at that, a very successful career. And so you can read in those first couple of chapters, chapter 2 in particular, about Mr. Armstrong going to his Uncle Frank to receive guidance and direction, to receive instruction on how to further his education and how to get practical experience, on-the-job experience. And then you read later in that same chapter about young Herbert Armstrong learning the rules of success, most of them. He didn't know the seventh and final one, the most important one. He'd learn that one later. But then, of course, those basic principles or rules, together with the seventh and final law of success that he learned later in life, he put that together in one of his most popular booklets titled The Seven Laws of Success. That was distributed to more than 3 million households on earth today. Of course, we have a copy of that same booklet available for free. If you don't have a copy, be sure and get one. But these next few clips, this is really it was kind of a fascinating study yesterday when I was just trying to pull together some research for the program. And Sam and I came upon this particular show from 1985. This is Mr. Armstrong's TV show. And of course, at that time in his ministry, he was still, even in his early 90s, he was still traveling the world, visiting with prominent world leaders. And in this case, he was visiting with a well-known Japanese business leader by the name of Mr. Yamaguchi. And this man had met Mr. Armstrong years earlier and really enjoyed him so much that he wanted him to come back to his company and give them a pep talk, to talk to them about the rules of success. And so Mr. Armstrong, when he got there, he presented Mr. Yamaguchi with a leather-bound copy of The Seven Laws of Success, and then they translated that booklet into Japanese so that all of the workers there at Mr. Yamaguchi's company, so that they, and hundreds of them, I think, so that they could read and study from that classic booklet, The Seven Laws of Success. Well, here in this first clip, you'll hear some from Mr. Yamaguchi himself, from Mr. Armstrong, and then you'll also hear some from the narrator who is explaining what's happening in this trip that Mr. Armstrong was on in 1985. So this is clip 2.
For the past 17 years, I have known many of the top officials in the Japanese government, and through them I've become acquainted with a major Japanese industrialist, Mr. Takeyoshi Yamaguchi. On my recent visit to Tokyo, Mr. Yamaguchi asked me to speak to a few thousand of his employees, and I did address them at an auditorium near one of his plants in Tokyo.
In Tokyo, Mr. Armstrong was driven to the Chinzanso Garden Restaurant, where several thousand senior sales staff of Japan Life Industries were meeting. Before Mr. Armstrong spoke, he presented Mr. Yamaguchi, chairman of the company, with an autographed leather-bound copy of his book, The Seven Laws of Success, and a copy of the same in the Japanese language. Meanwhile, the booklet in Japanese was distributed to the employees of Japan Life. Mr. Yamaguchi introduced Mr. Armstrong as the featured speaker.
こんにちは。 大変お待ち遠さまでした。 アームストロング博士にですね。
Good afternoon. In the midst of a busy schedule, Dr. Armstrong has been kind enough to come here to speak to you on an important and beneficial topic. Wherever he goes in the world, to kings, to presidents, or to other such people, Dr. Armstrong, at the age of 92, drives himself and expends great effort in the cause of world peace. Yesterday, I heard Dr. Armstrong give a lecture. He said, God gave man two choices to make. One was the give way. One was the get way.
これは神が与えた一つの選択でどっちでもしなさいと。
Choose either, God said, but know that by living the get way, mankind will probably destroy himself. But by living the give way, mankind would prosper. I realized we have come to the place where we must choose one way or the other. I would like to end my introduction, and without any more delay, I would like to ask Dr. Armstrong to speak. Thank you.
That's quite an introduction that Mr. Yamaguchi gave to Mr. Armstrong. I mean, just leaving aside the seven laws of success here for a second. I mean, what he said there at the end, that he heard Mr. Armstrong speak a couple days earlier and heard him talk about the two choices that we have before us, the give way and the get way, and that if we choose the get way, we're going to destroy ourselves. We're going to destroy ourselves. And then Mr. Yamaguchi telling his employees that we've come to the place where we have to choose one way or the other. That's quite that was quite an exchange. Quite a witness, I'd say, too. And it happened in Tokyo, just outside of Tokyo at a big company. And everyone gathered there. I mean, not many of them knew English, I would presume. And you had translators working in both directions. Well, then Mr. Armstrong gets up and he had distributed that leather-bound copy of the Seven Laws of Success, and everyone there in the audience, I guess the narrator said there that it was thousands, everyone in the audience there was given a copy of the Seven Laws of Success in Japanese, and Mr. Armstrong then went on to talk about these rules or laws for success. The first one here, this is from clip 3.
And the first law is choosing the right vocation. Now, I assume that all of you are already committed to your economic vocation in life. You have your job and you have your way of earning a living. But there is still something else in choosing the right goal, and that is to develop the right kind of righteous character that I mentioned a while ago. Now, in that goal, if you're going to achieve it, I'll come back to what I was saying that Mr. Yamaguchi mentioned that I said at the banquet last night. There are the two ways, and one is the way of give, and the other is the way of get. Whatever you do, if you are employed and you work for a company, the more you give of the best that you have, of your talents, of your honesty, of faithfulness in every way, the more righteous character you develop and the happier you will be. So the first law of success is choosing the right goal in life.
Choosing the right goal in life. And so you can, in going through the early chapters of the autobiography, you can see how God was working on his mind. Of course, when he was 18, he wasn't yet converted to the truth. That wouldn't happen for another 15, 16 years. And so, but still, just learning about what he was good at, the fact that he would pour his heart into advertising, as he explains all through the autobiography, I mean, he was motivated a lot by vanity before his conversion, but he did educate himself. He did have a strong ambition, and he said better to have that than to be lazy and shiftless. So he had this burning desire to be successful, and then, of course, when God humbled him and brought him to the point of conversion, that life goal changed, and dramatically so. Mr. Armstrong wrote, "I think there's no other secret that has had more to do with preserving youthful vitality and zeal and keeping me alive and active more than 14 years past the supposed allotted lifespan. That life goal keeps me always looking forward in anticipation, not backward. Living in the past, it impels me to observe carefully many of the other laws of success." So once he got that right goal, well, then he really looked forward in anticipation. It did impel him to move ahead. The right goal, as he said in the booklet, this is the 7 laws of success, the right goal will arouse ambition. And then he explains how that this is more than just the desire to achieve, but also the will, the effort to put forth what you need to do to succeed. Well, he went on in this lecture before these employees to then talk about the second law. This is clip number 4.
Now, the second law of success, then, is acquiring the right knowledge, the know-how to achieve that goal and to live in a way that will make you a success. You should study to educate yourself for your job, that you can do your job better, because the very law of success will cause you to step on up in the ladder of success if you are acquiring more knowledge, more of the know-how, and learning more how to do whatever job you're doing. We should all continue to study, because education is of the mind and it is a lifelong process. We never stop learning. And if the mind stagnates, you just get very old in every way, and finally you give up and die. So always keep learning more and more, and keep your minds active. Now, the third law of success, and this is a law, it'll work every time, is if you're going to be a success, you have to have energy, you have to have vitality. I am now in my 93rd year, but I have seen many people only 55 or 60 years old who look and appear in every way much older than I do.
That's Herbert Armstrong speaking before that company, Japan Life, back in 1985. And as you heard from the introduction, I mean, Mr. Yamaguchi himself, in introducing Herbert Armstrong, said he was 92 and that he drives himself and that he expends great effort in the cause of world peace. What an example. And Mr. Armstrong there in that bit we just played, talking about the all-important rules of education and health. How he had so much energy. How he had so much youthful vitality. He educated himself through and through, as I say, when he was young and he was really going after his career in advertising. That's what the education revolved around largely. And then later when the goal changed, boy, he immersed himself into the knowledge of God, the truth of God. He immersed himself into the Bible. He educated himself. He kept learning more and more and more. He kept his mind active and then his body as well in good health so that he could have the energy and the vitality he needed to do the work, to serve God. Well, next to go through these points, this is from that same lecture he gave in 1985. He continues on with these rules for success. Clip 5.
The next thing is, if you're going to be a success, you have to drive yourself. You have to cause yourself to, well, get up in the morning when you want to turn over and sleep a little longer. And you have to drive yourself to do what you ought to do instead of just giving up to do what maybe you'd like to do. When you are employed and you work for a company, drive yourself to work as hard as you can and to do the job the best you can. After having the right purpose and goal in life and studying to educate yourself and to have the know-how to do the job and driving yourself, the next thing is you're going to run into many problems and many snags in your life, and you're going to find that great obstacles confront you sometimes. So that law of success is simply resourcefulness. You have to be able to think your way around every problem that comes up in your life. Now, the sixth law of success, then, is sticking to it and never giving up and never quitting, or perseverance. We should never give up. Many people have given up and quit when, if they had just stayed on a little longer, their lives might have been a great success.
That's from his lecture at Japan Life in 1985, rattling off the fourth, fifth, and sixth laws: drive, resourcefulness, and perseverance. Now you go back to chapter 2 when he was just learning these rules of success as a young man, as a teenager. At the age of 18 even, he said he was learning some of these seven important rules. The first success rule is fixing the right goal. He talked about not being a square peg in a round hole. Mr. Armstrong wrote, "I was yet to learn the real purpose of life and the one true supreme goal. Actually, I had set out on a wrong goal, that of becoming someone important, achieving business success and status for the purpose of making money. But at least I had made the self-analysis and the survey of vocations to find where I should fit within the realm of business, the field of this goal. At least ambition had been kindled." He said, and though little realized at the time, all this experience was building the necessary foundation for the worldwide activities of later life. God was laying the groundwork, you see. He says in chapter 2 of the autobiography that the second success rule is education, fitting oneself for the achievement of the goal. And he talks a lot about that in the first few chapters of his autobiography. He was getting, with respect to advertising, he was getting not merely the classroom book education. I mean, he did that too, because he was studying late at night. But he was also on the job, gaining experience that way. Well, he talks about the third rule being vigorous health, and how that he learned about the importance of proper food also a little bit later in life, when he was in his mid-30s. The fourth rule, drive, he wrote, putting a constant prod on oneself seems to have come naturally as a result of the ambition that had been generated at age 16. He says here, there was always the sense that I had to hurry. I was learning to plunge into a task with dynamic energy. The fifth law, resourcefulness, or thinking about the problem at hand, was unconsciously being developed by experience. And he gives some examples to that effect. And then finally, the sixth rule, or second to the last rule, perseverance, not quitting. As Uncle Frank said, keep the job that you started with. There was another one that came along a few months later that offered $2 more per week. And he didn't go after that higher paying job because his uncle said, look, you've got to stick with it. You've got to persevere. There's a tendency in our family to not see something through to the end. So don't do that. Stay with it. Honor your commitment. Well, then he says in chapter 2, the seventh and most important rule I was not to learn until much later. And here at that Japan Life lecture that he gave in 1985, he talks about that seventh all-important rule that he wouldn't learn until later in life. This is clip number 6.
Now, the seventh law really should come first, because that comes in choosing the right goal in the first place. We human beings did not just happen here. There was a great creator who had to think out and plan and design our minds and our bodies and create us and put us together and give us life and give us the means of sustaining that life here on this earth. This creator God showed that very first man that the right way of life is the way of love, that there would be other humans on earth, and that he must learn to love other people as much as himself.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1985, quite a warning and witness to those employees at Japan Life. They're talking about the seventh law and how that really, it should come first because it's the most important law. Once he learned that, like with these others, Mr. Armstrong immersed himself into it and really developed an unbelievable relationship with his creator, the great creator God. That is all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.